Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. If you can't listen right now, if you can't hear me on Comcast Cable, please raise your hand. We'll send a truck out as soon as we can get to it. I saw the map, Ryan, and it looks like there's quite an area, a number of areas around the country that Comcast is dealing with right now.
Yeah, if you dig into it a little bit, it looks like it's downtown Chicago is kind of one of the hot spots. And actually, up in your neck of the woods, Deerfield, Lincolnshire, looks like they've also got some problems going on.
Well, get your 9-volt battery. The transistor radio is always working. No problem there.
It stinks. A lot of the kiddies are off today, and a lot of people are off as well for the holiday. So what do this is the day to binge watch, right?
Well, maybe they'll just have to talk to each other. All right, we got a lot going on today. Philip Weiss is here, the managing director of Seyfarth Shaw at Work, because, we're coming off the Valentine's Day sugar high, maybe, and here we are on President's Day, so I want to talk about a couple of holidays with Philip. Molly Jacobson, a little bit later, the owner at Jacobson Strategy, will talk about marketing your small business, and she runs a marketing firm, and she seems to be arguing that you don't really need a marketing firm, so we're going to sort that out a little bit. Also in Springfield, just wrapping up, I think there was a news conference with Senator Durbin and other education leaders, and they're talking about how higher education is suffering because of the budget standoff that continues in Springfield. We'll talk to David Treader, the president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. Right now, we say hello to Philip Weiss. Philip, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good to see you, Steve.
All right, so Seyfarth Shaw at Work is basically a company that helps other companies stay out of legal trouble. How did I do there?
Very well. Better than I usually do, actually.
Well, tell me about what it does.
What we do is we take, whether it's the law or legal developments, as you and I discuss on the radio, or companies' rules and policies, and we reduce them to something simple, user-friendly. So whether it's an employee or, sadly, sometimes a CEO, people know what rules to follow and how to do it.
And so when it comes to workplace romances, are there a lot of rules?
There are. Well, actually, there aren't many rules because the courts tend to expect that we know what we're doing when it comes to avoiding romance.
Seems like if there's anyone that needs rules, it would be workplace romances.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting area, and Valentine's Day is the right time to think about it. I mean, I think a lot of lawyers are fond of Valentine's Day, and it's not because we're all about love. It's more about the risks that you're referring to.
Well, I'm thinking today, okay, the day after Valentine's Day, do we have more people in the office engaged in workplace romances who are sort of starry-eyed or more who are angry with each other because there's trouble around there?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. When we've surveyed our own clients, late February is one of the times when you see more romances begin, along with post-mergers. You bring people in, people
really?
Meet people.
Oh, interesting.
But Valentine's is one of those moments, so I think you're in that starry-eyed honeymoon period that will slowly destabilize into litigation and risk.
So you guys have actually looked at that when after mergers, there's more likely to be office romance?
There is. And so we're then tracking what happens next. Valentine's itself has its own Valentine's Day, Valentine's Week, has its own pot of risks. Some of them relate to something as simple as the gifts people give for Valentine's Day. You see this phenomenon of office spouses. Someone deciding that somebody else in the office or workplace is their special someone.
Right.
Meaning it's ostensibly platonic. The problem is when Valentine's Day comes around, people turn that opportunity into one to share cards and other gifts that don't sound as platonic as you'd expect.
So they get in a little trouble with the language on the card.
They do. In fact, one client came to us last February because an office husband received a card from his office wife.
Interesting.
You're saying, I love you as my office spouse. I wish it wasn't just 9 to 5. She claimed that was a joke,
right?
Meant as a term of endearment, but it destabilized their relationship as well as that with his real spouse back at home.
Well, when I was in third grade, we had to give those little Cupid cards to everyone in the class.
Right.
Couldn't give them to anyone.
Yeah, third grade's a good time to think about starting to stop that process.
All right, when I think of romance in the workplace, I think of maybe illicit liaisons in the workplace, which happens, I would imagine. Do you have any numbers on that?
We have sort of percentages. We've never counted.
You don't have raw numbers?
No. We try not to count. Though maybe for next time.
10%, 15%?
Yeah, well, the statistics, the surveys indicate, and these are anonymous surveys, Steve, for obvious reasons,
right,
that up to 15 to 20% of individuals have acknowledged a romantic tryst taking place in the office.
In the workplace.
And that's half of the people who admit engaging in some kind of relationship with a coworker. So it's happening. The question is, how do you manage it and how do you prevent it from escalating?
All right, let's do that. So you're running the company and you find out that this couple is engaging in that way in the workplace. What do you do?
Well, it's a great question, because certainly people can date other people at the workplace, or I should say from the workplace, not at the workplace.
Well, it turns out they do.
Yes, they do. In fact, 20 years ago, Steve, most companies tried to regulate that. Say, date no one at work. This is purely professional. That approach, those sets of policies tend to fail because you're with these people so long.
Right.
So now it's a matter of understanding when to draw the line. And one area to draw the line is when you have a power differential. So anybody with more power dating anybody with less power is a recipe for trouble. You're rolling the dice, because you can't really be sure that if you get sued, and that does happen when people change their minds,
right.
and the breakup happens, you can't be sure that you can prove it was consensual. Because if their job, in their mind, relied on them dating you, if their opportunities relied on them getting intimate with you, you actually have a hill to climb in terms of your defense.
You know, it used to be that there were pretty strict rules about you couldn't work with someone with whom you were married.
Yes.
And that used to be the case here, and then that kind of went away. And is that going away sort of as a trend?
It is. The trend moves away from that. In fact, in larger companies, you can actually even date somebody who may have higher authority, but they're going to be moved, or you're going to be moved to a different part of the organization. Mm. So there's been a certain evolution in terms of thought and process. But managers still are not catching on. Some managers, not only do they believe that there's no power differential issue, they believe they can keep it a secret until they need to release it.
Well, of course they do.
Yes.
Right? Because it's such a personal thing. You think, well, here's a rule, here's a policy, but I got this under control.
Right. That's exactly what they think. And they feel that control, Steve, because the employee with whom they're involved seems to be supporting whatever they want.
Right.
Because they're an employee.
All right. So real quick, here we are on President's Day. And if people aren't talking about their busted romances today, maybe they're talking about politics, the race for president, the Scalia death, and the appointment and all of that. How do you negotiate that in the workplace?
Yeah, that's another really important issue. And we're seeing many more claims and complaints related to politics in the workplace than we ever did before. The key is to really look at these conversations while they're still simply a workplace distraction,
mm-hmm.
because they've gone from distraction to a moment of aggravation to even rage.
I mean, it used to be that you didn't talk politics, and if you did, it was a bit more sedate.
Right.
And now it's just angry.
It's angry, and it affects relationships at work, Steve. It also affects relationships with customers. Many companies in retail tell us that, you know what, the common cards we're getting from our customers is, why did the cashier talk to me about politics?
And you know, the thing is, if you're a true believer on the right or the left, you're convinced, you think everyone else thinks that way too.
Right.
And that's a great point. And then when you start sharing that with people who don't, that costs the company business.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an echo chamber. In your mind, it's not in the real world, and it has effects business and legal.
Right. So put your Trump sticker away and take off your Bernie Sanders bumper sticker and take them out when you go home.
Right. Dress for success, not for the campaign.
When you date the CEO on the weekend.
Or maybe not.
Philip Weiss, the managing director of Seyfarth Shaw at Work. Thanks for coming in today. Nice to see you. It's 12:23 on the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand in on this Monday afternoon. All right, about an hour ago, maybe a little less than an hour ago, a news conference in Springfield wrapped up. Senator Durbin was there, along with education leaders, some union leaders, I think, as well, talking about the impact of the long budget impasse, the impact that it has been having on higher education in the state. You know, we've talked about Chicago State here. There have been marches in Chicago. There's been talk of layoffs at Eastern in Charleston, in Macomb, at Western Illinois University, layoffs as well. David Treader is the president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities, and he was at that news conference this afternoon. He joins us on the Business Lunch. David, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Steve.
I got to tell you, the first thing I learned when I was reading about you and about this topic is that there are 57 independent, not-for-profit universities around Illinois. I did not know there were that many.
Certainly a big group, and many of them in the Chicago area, which certainly you and your listeners know. You know, the DePauls, Loyolas, Roosevelt, Columbia's, and then a bunch more down.
Yeah,
big group.
All right, so which one's your favorite?
Well, if I answered that, I'd be fired immediately.
All right. So tell me about this, because, you know, one of the things that has interested me in this budget impasse is that it has really had a great impact on some and very little impact on others. And the sort of outrage or frustration has just not caught fire around the state. What's happening at universities around Illinois? I know about the MAP grant funding. Are there other monies that the state schools should be getting that they're not?
Well, yeah, certainly the operational money for the public fours and community colleges has not been appropriated. So really, 8 months in, there's zero on the board for higher education, which is just kind of unfathomable that many of these institutions are even able to open their doors still, I think.
Have they been just operating thinking, well, the check's in the mail, I mean, it's going to come eventually?
Well, I think that continues to be the hope, because that will be the first time in Illinois history that we've done that, and I think both those of us on the private side of higher education, on the public side, just have a hard time believing that the state will let what we argue is the state's biggest economic engine just crater.
All right, so let's take a school, a hypothetical school, and they're not getting the money that they would get from the state. Where are they getting the money they need to operate, and if they have the money to operate, do they need all that money from the state?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, remember that this is, if you look at the appropriations for the last 10 years in higher education in Illinois, it's been a gradual slope down. So this is kind of the cherry on top of really a death by a thousand cuts. But I think for most of the institutions that are able to keep the doors open, they're depleting reserves, extending credit to students who are owed a MAP grant.
Mm-hmm.
But if that money never comes through, I mean, I think it's a pretty short window that the schools will either be cut drastically on what they do, and I think we're already hearing some of them are going to have a hard time making payroll with the story about Chicago State last week.
Right. Chicago State says they might have to close next month in a few weeks if they don't get some money coming in. I want to ask you about, because let's assume that the money's going to come eventually. I mean, they tend to fix things in one way or another, whether or not that's the right way to do it. They tend to come through with the money. But I want to ask about the long-term impact when it comes to reputation and all of that. I've got a senior in high school, and we're looking at schools, and, you know, the U of I was maybe on the list, but I'm thinking it's a mess around here, and I think I'm going to look elsewhere with my big money trying to fund my kids' education. So when this stuff happens, what is the long-term impact on reputation in the state?
Well, I think it's huge. Some of that's hard to measure, but you would be a perfect example of not having confidence that these institutions are going to be funded in a way going forward. So, you know, I think you're already starting to see decreases in enrollment in second semester, and then I expect if this problem is not solved really quickly, that, you know, other states who are already looking at our state for students, I mean, Missouri, Iowa, you know, those states both have a fast track for residency just so students don't have to pay out-of-state tuition. So it's already occurring right now. It's just a matter of, you know, counting the people that are leaving the state. And remember, Illinois has historically been a big exporter, you know, second in the country behind New Jersey, exporting students out of here. So it's always been a problem. This is just going to completely put that whole issue on steroids.
David Treader, the president of the Federation of Independent Illinois Colleges and Universities. Look, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's a Monday afternoon on 720 WGN. Our small business around this country accounts for 54% of all U.S. sales. In fact, by some counts, there are as many as 28 million small businesses around the country. And obviously, if they want to increase sales and make themselves known, they need to figure out a way to market themselves. More often than not, or I shouldn't say more often than not, but often they will go to a professional marketing company to help get the word out. One of those professional marketing companies is run by Molly Jacobs, and she's the owner and founder of Jacobs and Strategy. But I think she's going to make the argument today that maybe those marketing companies aren't so needed. Molly Jacobson, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Good afternoon.
All right, so are you arguing against your own company here?
Well, it's a bit contrarian, but to be honest with you, look, there are certain companies out there who do benefit from having a full firm or a specialist of a sort. Don't get me wrong, there is a need, especially for the bigger companies. Now, for small business owners, it's different. You know, it's a bit daunting to a lot of business owners, the whole marketing thing. They have enough on their plate. They're running a business. They're getting this thing built up the best they can. And when a business owner starts that business, they have a dream of building this into something of a success. And, you know, part of that equation into making it into a success is marketing. But they're overwhelmed. They don't really understand how to go about it. So I see three scenarios for small business owners. I see them choosing, okay, I'm going to go after this. I'm going to try my hand. But they don't have a strategy. They don't have an understanding of how to use the tools accessible to them. And then there's the other small business owners that say, you know what, I know exactly what I'm doing. I am a master at this, whatever, you know, the business is, and they don't go after the marketing. Or there's the ones who hire a firm or a specialist, and they spend big bucks to do this.
Well, I think, you know, if you're running, if I'm running a hot dog shop and I want to get customers or, you know, a dry cleaning business or something like that, I'm going to focus on my dry cleaning. I'm going to focus on my relish with the idea that I'm going to turn things over to a professional marketing person to get people in the door.
Right.
But I guess now, the mistake is thinking that I don't myself have the wherewithal to get the job done myself.
Sure. And that's understandable. And, you know, hiring a firm, hiring somebody, that's expensive. And if you're trying to build your business, you don't want to take on more overhead for something you can do yourself. And so while I do work with clients and provide marketing and public relations services, what I also do is for the small business owners, I empower them to be able to do this on their own, setting up a strategy, providing them and helping them learn how to use the tools available to them, and then coaching them along the way, doing periodic check-ins as needed. And, you know, like I mentioned, tools, there's so many out there that are just fantastic and extremely inexpensive, and many are free.
All right, tell me about some of those tools. As you know, I've identified my target audience, and you suggest, you know, figure out where they shop, what they read, find out as much as you can about them. How does a guy running a business do that himself or herself?
Well, exactly like you said, you have to start off and really assess, look at who your customer, who your audience is. Now, you want to know where does this person come from? Where do they shop? Where do they hear and read the news? What are their values? And then with that, you can determine what are the best methods to reach out to my audience. And first, you also want to make sure you have a very clear and simple message that explains exactly why they should go to you for whatever it may be and how you are better than the competitor. So you want to distinguish yourself from the crowd of chaos and tons of others out there trying to get your same audience. So some tools out there that I think are just fantastic. One for email marketing is Constant Contact. It's so easy to use. I'm not being paid by them, I swear to say this. But it's one that I use a great deal, and I think it's fantastic.
How does it work? Tell me about it, Molly.
Yeah, so it's a platform that's online. You can have a subscription. It's really inexpensive, and you can build your list. Now, this is super important, building that list, that database. So whenever you have the opportunity, go out there, get email addresses, get their names, find out where they're from, any information you can, because you want to build your database, and be able to reach out to them and provide emails, you know, invite them to follow your social media channels, and let them know about the neat, great things that are coming out about your company.
That's all. It's keeping them engaged, isn't it? Just keeping them, keeping you on their mind.
Exactly. And the next is, so for all of those individuals out there who think that, you know, oh man, how am I going to do an email campaign, or how am I going to promote on social media? I don't have a graphic designer. I don't have like all this fancy stuff. All right, you don't need them. The answer to this is called Canva, canva.com. And I love Canva. Another big one is PicMonkey, PicMonkey.com.
Okay, what do they do? What do they do for us?
Yeah, so on these platforms, you can create amazing graphics, all kinds, and really, you know, make it look professional as if you hired somebody to do this. So, you know, you can upload your own logos, you can, and a big thing, you want to make sure you're staying in brand. So when you're making these different graphics, you want to make sure that you're using consistency as far as your branding. So for colors, for fonts, things like that, just something to consider. But you don't need to be a Photoshop wizard any longer. You can use these tools and they are great.
Okay, so tell me again, PicMonkey was one, P-I-C, like PicMonkey. I got that one. And the first one was Canva?
Canva, CANVA.com. And I am not a spokesperson, I swear.
Well, you should be because you're doing a very good job for them, Molly. So
well, thank you.
So you're suggesting people go to websites like that and they can create their own logos and marketing materials that way.
That's right.
Okay, but so, okay, and so I see that, but there's still, not to argue against you, but there's got to be sort of a degree of intelligence or experience that comes with the marketing professional that you're not going to get sitting down on your own.
Well, yeah. And, you know, with that being said, it's really a level of strategy and having the big picture to be able to determine where do I want to pull all of these pieces and put them together.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's helpful to utilize somebody who does have that knowledge, but you don't need to hire, you know, a monthly retainer firm to be able to get this. And so somebody like myself who does offer coaching to be able to provide the steps and the plan and the strategy for you to then move forward with, you know, that's a real different approach that, frankly, you know, firms would hate me for saying because it's just the typical marketing firm structure is not for everyone. And, you know, this is a personalized approach that's very much putting the entrepreneur, putting the business owner, you know, in the hands of empowerment. And I think that's important. I think that, you know, marketing is such an important piece of achieving success that to be able to give that power to the business owner rather than taking it away by saying, okay, you know, we're going to take it from here. No, you've got this. You're intelligent. You started a business. You know what you're doing.
You
just need a little support.
You talk about maintaining the brand. And, you know, I think of certain things I've done or tried and it's sort of slipshod. Like, I'll give this a shot. Well, then I'll give that a shot. And so I might have these tools at my disposal, but I don't maybe have a continuity or a strategy, which isn't always slick. But I guess that's probably one of the most important things to focus on.
It is. And so, you know, being able to, before pulling out all of these different tools that I'm talking about, and you know, it's really important to first have that vision, to first determine what am I after, what is my objective here, and how am I going to go after it. So I do recommend, you know, having somebody who has that knowledge, somebody like myself, and I encourage you to go to jacobsonstrategy.com where you can sign up for a free consultation for coaching.
Now wait, are you are a spokeswoman for Jacobson Strategy, I'm assuming?
I am.
Well, that's good. You should be.
All transparency.
Listen, you've been helpful. I appreciate it. JacobsonStrategy.com is the website. Molly Jacobson says that, you know, marketing, if you're worried about it or concerned about it, want to do it, maybe you could do it on your own or do a lot more than you think. There are tools out there, and I appreciate your help with that. Thanks very much, Molly.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Have a good week. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It is 12:50 here on The Business Lunch, 720 WGN. I'm Steve Bertrand. All right, so when you talk to Siri, you ask Siri about something, or you have a voice recognition software on your phone, what that phone does is take the information, the data from you, and then send it to a much bigger, much more powerful computer. That allows for it to compute what exactly it's looking at, what it's hearing, and relay that back again to your smartphone. But what if it didn't have to relay it at all? What if it all could be done at your phone? That's one of the areas of growing development in this country. Vivian C. is a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT, and she joins us now on a phone line. Dr. C., welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve.
All right, so let's go to San Francisco, right? There was just a big show in San Francisco where you unveiled this new chip. I think you're calling it Iris. Tell me about Iris.
Right. So Iris is a very low-power deep learning chip, as you mentioned, that can do applications such as image recognition and image classification, meaning you can give it an image and it will tell you what's actually in the image itself.
And how does it work now without Iris?
The way it works right now is that primarily what Iris does is a deep learning functionality. So you use deep learning to do this image classification. Currently what you would do is you would capture an image, you know, upload it to Google or send it on the web, and this type of processing would happen in a data center remotely, and then they would give you the response.
And why is it that that's something that we need to improve on? Why isn't the current system good enough?
Right. So you can think of there are several reasons why you might not want to upload your data to the internet. So first, there are cases where you're not connected to the internet. We're not always going to be connected to Wi-Fi. The second reason might be privacy, right? So you could imagine one of the compelling applications for using computer vision would be to, let's say, help the blind or visually impaired. And one would not want to be able to share everything that they're looking at with, you know, someone online, right? So for privacy reasons, you might want to do all the recognition locally on your device. Another good application for computer vision are things like robotics and self-driving cars. And in that situation, there's a latency, a transmission latency delay, you know, when you send images from a camera on, you know, through the internet coming back, and you might not be able to tolerate that delay if you're doing navigation.
Right. So if you're in a self-driving car and you're coming upon a corner or an intersection or a vehicle or a person, you don't want to wait for the data to go to a big computer somewhere over the internet, come back to your car, and then create some sort of reaction.
Right. You only have a few milliseconds to react in those cases. Or, you know, what if your internet connection breaks off, right? You need to be very secure in terms of making the right decision.
And so if this is this brand new technology, or are there other companies coming up with it? I mean, are you the sole innovator, or are you one of many?
Well, there's certainly this is a very hot area of research. So over the past couple of years, deep learning, which is a specific type of artificial intelligence, has really, you know, made significant progress. So there's a lot of people looking in terms of how do you improve the algorithms, and there's a lot of researchers and companies looking into how we can improve the hardware, both within the cloud, so in the data centers, and then also locally on something like a handheld device.
And so is it inevitable? Our cell phones are going to have this deep learning capability?
I would imagine so. In a couple of years, we should be expecting this capability on cell phone, as well as many other devices in terms of like wearables, and then also, you know, Internet of Things. So being able to enable any device with kind of a camera with this technology, that would be the ultimate vision.
Is it the sort of thing, I mean, you know, I keep bringing up cell phones because that's something that everyone has, mm-hmm. but maybe that's not really the area where this technology would be most useful.
Right. So if you think about the way in which you're using, or the way people are starting to use cameras these days, it's not just to capture an image and share that image with someone. It's actually to capture information.
Mm-hmm.
I think a good example to think of would be, for example, a traffic camera, where what you're trying to capture there is the number of cars, is there congestions or not. The pixels or the image themselves are not so meaningful. So you can imagine in something like a traffic camera in the future, you would want to enable some form of deep learning or intelligence in that device so that the only information it has to send is the number of cars or if there's a congestion and so on. And so that's also useful in terms of limiting the amount of data you have to send to the cloud, and then also for privacy reasons, again, that would be useful.
So is this going to be a sort of a revolutionary development when it comes to all of us, or is this going to be a significant development that maybe all of us won't be recognizing?
Well, I think it will impact the way in which, you know, data is collected and processed. And so it might not be, I mean, it might change our habits and how we interact with devices, because you could imagine this is kind of further. A device could see you. The way you talk to Siri, you could also use visual data and interact with a device, but they won't be sharing that information with any third party. Or you could imagine in kind of a more industrial setting where, you know, companies need to collect data for, you know, improving efficiency in their shops and so on, and they would also be collecting.
Right. So when I talk to Siri and I want to know who that actor was in Pretty in Pink in 1995, that's still right. going to require an internet connection.
I mean, in certain applications, if you can store a large enough of a database on your system, you could probably do the classification locally. So what we do with like the image processing side would be you train this very large network, what we call a neural network, which is a, you know, fundamental block in deep learning, to recognize images. And so basically once you put some pixels in, it will tell you, you know, what exactly it's taking a look at. So similarly for speech processing, you could put in, you know, some voice activity and it would tell you, it would interpret what you're requesting.
So it sounds like we might almost one day be able to be carrying much of the internet but that we would personally use around with us on the phone with no need to go to the web.
For a subset of the things that you would do on the web, you could do that on the phone potentially.
Professor, all I would really need would be IMDb to check the movies and TV and music from the mid-80s. And that's all I really use the computer for.
Well, then I think you're set.
How long do we have to wait?
I think you should expect this technology to come in the next couple of years. I mean, we can already do it with the, you know, as I said, and the internet. The question is, how much of that processing do you move locally onto your device?
That is Professor Vivian See, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT. And the chip we're talking about is called Iris. Keep your eye out for it. It is coming your way. Professor, thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.